Today is Thursday, January 16th. We are starting on page 8 with Diabetes Insipidus. Okay, so when we talk about anti-diuretic hormone, we know that hormone promotes water retention. And I don't want you to think of it as a bad thing, because if we don't retain water, we're going to be peeing the water out all the time. As it is, we are going to urinate about a liter or a liter and a half of urine per day. Nobody wants to spend hours in the bathroom having to relieve themselves more often than we already do, right? So frequent urination would occur if you don't have a way to maintain water balance and to keep the water that you do have in your body. This particular form of diabetes is actually pretty rare. It is not the type of diabetes you normally think about when somebody says diabetes. Notice this type is called diabetes insipidus, and it is caused by a lack of ADH. In fact, if you drink alcohol and you urinate frequently, it's the same aspect. You're looking at frequent urination when you drink alcohol. Likewise, if you shut off ADH production, that's what's going to happen, is there's going to be frequent urination. So which of these two terms here, polyuria or polydipsia, means frequent urination?
Polyuria.
Good. And what does polydipsia mean?
Thirsty.
Thirsty. Good. I tell you a really great clue. Look at the sipping up here. That's a great reminder that this particular form of diabetes is always thirsty. Of course, polydipsia, there we go. Because there's no blood glucose problem for a person who has this form of diabetes. Okay, let me repeat that. There is no blood glucose problem. There is no insulin problem. There is no pancreas problem. This is just a person who's thirsty and who's peeing frequently. That's it. Okay, so frequent thirst followed by frequent urination. So if a person happens to have this disorder, then there's a hyposecretion of ADH. We need to look at where that's coming from. Where in the brain is ADH produced?
Hypothalamus.
And where is it released from?
Posterior.
Yeah, posterior pituitary. So an MRI of the brain can actually tell us a little bit about what's going on with those two regions and help us know a little bit more about, you know, if there's something going wrong with those two areas. In the meantime, if we can't figure out a way to stop it, we can medicate a person with this condition, and we can give them a synthetic form of ADH, and it's called vasopressin. Okay, so vaso, vessel, and pressin gives you an idea of what's happening. What do you think vasopressin does? Restricts, yeah. It squeezes your blood vessels, and what happens to your blood pressure when you get uptight? Raises up, yeah. So that's in fact what vasopressin does. It allows somebody to increase their blood pressure with less water, but nonetheless it does the same ultimate effect of increasing pressure like ADH should. So in a person who has this form of diabetes, vasopressin would be administered to help them maintain their blood pressure. So there are what they call like first level medications that all countries should have, no matter what country of the world a person lives in. This is one of those type of like first level medications that's very important to have. It's very important to stay hydrated and not be dehydrated. So all countries of the world, if they have basic medical supplies, should have something like this that can help a person maintain their hydration status. All right, so that should wrap up page 8. How about any questions so far up to page 8? Is everything making sense so far in this class? Okay. Anything I can go back and clarify for you? It's just a lot to keep straight, isn't it? It's like alphabet soup, right? Okay. The next one is the thyroid gland. It's found on page 9, and it's nowhere near as complicated as all this anterior pituitary hormone stuff. In fact, the thyroid gland produces only two major hormones. Where do you find the thyroid gland?
Around the trachea.
Around the trachea, good. It's shaped like a butterfly or bow tie. It should wrap itself around the front and the two sides of your trachea. Just because it's on this picture, I'm going to mention them. The parathyroid glands are 4 to 8 nodules of tissue that sit on the backside. So if you were you're able to take off your thyroid and look at the backside of it, you would find those tiny little knots of tissue for the parathyroid glands. Okay, so thyroid gland, parathyroid glands have real tight, close relationship there. How do you think somebody would feel if their thyroid gland gets bigger or hypertrophies?
Nervous, sweaty.
Nervous and sweaty? You want to share?
Yeah, I had, actually had a fibroid tumors in my thyroid, big nodules that were not cancerous, and it threw me into hyperthyroid. I lost like 60 pounds in 3 months.
Wow.
Had to have my thyroid removed, and it was nervous, jittery. You always feel like you're nervous. They would treat me for anxiety because my thyroid sat real low behind my collarbone, so I didn't get the goiter right away until it got really big.
Oh wow!
So they didn't know what was wrong with me. So I was taking anti-anxiety medication. It wasn't doing anything. It was the jitters and the nervousness and just the sweating all the time. But it always felt like just been on the treadmill. So it was bad.
So did they eventually scan to see that there was
they
a goiter?
They did. Fine needle biopsies. Okay. They scanned first, found out that it was huge because the goiter started sticking out on one side. And they did 26 fine needle aspiration biopsies. Jeez. To get samples of it to determine if it was cancerous or not. Because of the type of fibroid tumors I had, it mimics follicular cancer in the thyroid. They thought I had stage 4 cancer. Because it was growing something else, I did not.
Very lucky.
They took the whole thyroid out.
They left your parathyroids?
Yes.
Okay.
Because they do calcium, so they got to have them if they can leave them.
So I guess they had to be careful in teasing them off the backside.
And they monitor, after they take your thyroid out, they monitor your calcium levels for the first 3 weeks to make sure your parathyroids were not damaged and that you can still regulate blood calcium levels.
That's good. That's good. It's certainly a case of being an advocate for your own health, is not just taking the
it's
first.
It's scary. It started off feeling like a grape, like the size of a grape in my neck, and grew to the size of a golf ball.
Wow.
Really quick.
But down low, you're right. That wouldn't necessarily.
Yeah, my thyroid was abnormally low. It's down inside my collarbone, and not up.
Wow.
Where most people says. So you didn't see the goiter right away.
Wow.
They thought I had a bad anxiety, and it was not anxiety.
Not at all anxiety. It would give you anxiety to have it not treated.
You feel like it's anxiety.
Yeah.
Because your heart's racing and you're sweating and it feels like a panic attack, what they describe a panic attack as. Because when I described it to the doctor, they thought I was having a panic attack.
Classic Graves' disease.
Yeah. Big time.
Thanks for sharing. Yeah. I'm kind of on the opposite end. Thyroid conditions are certainly very common, especially in females. I have a hypothyroid condition, and I had the opposite effects of being sluggish, not able to lose weight, feeling kind of like in a mental fog. You know, like when you get up in the middle of the night, and you're not quite sure of where everything is. And you imagine being like that during the daytime. So thankfully, they tested. They found out that I had low levels of thyroid hormones produced here, and then I've been on medication for almost 20 years. So it seems to me that females have it more commonly than males, but anybody who has metabolism order,
it's an autoimmune disease is what they told me the time I had, because it was a fibrocystic disease. I have other fibrocystic diseases. So
it's a shame it took them that long to figure out for you what was going on.
It all happened real quick, all within a year. I had fibroid tumors so bad in the uterus I had to have a hysterectomy, and that was causing all kind of hormonal issues, and then this. But it all happened within a year's time. It was like a ticking time bomb, and it all went crazy at once.
Wow.
But apparently I always had it. It just hadn't grown to the point that it caused me trouble.
Wow. And it's amazing that it does mimic like other things that might be going on.
It's autoimmune. Yeah. They think that it's all tied together.
I think you'll find out more and more that things like autoimmune or chemicals or stresses, whatever, play roles with this particular gland. So, interesting gland. Let's go ahead and talk about the inside of it, because it's looking at this, if you were to actually dig into it and take a look at the cellular structure inside of that thyroid gland, you're looking at areas of gel called colloid, and that's this pink stuff here, the lighter pink stuff or purple stuff. And then there's these cells that wrap around that colloid, and those are called follicle cells. I kind of imagine of doing an aerial flyover at a bunch of lakes, and you're looking down at these storage lakes and a bunch of land surrounding each of those lakes. These follicle cells actually do surround that colloid, and they secrete thyroxine, which is thyroid hormone, and they store it in that colloid. The other cells that are in the background, do you know what they're called? They're not background cells, they're parafollicle cells. So those parafollicle cells actually make calcitonin. We'll talk about those in just a moment. So here's an interesting thing. When I got tested for thyroid hormone back almost 20 years ago, you know, a few years later, I felt a little better, and I said, you know, I'd like to go off the medication and just see how I can do without it. And, you know, that's not happening, because once you're on it, it's like you're hooked. You know, you can't get off the thyroid medication. And they said, well, if you go off the medication, then you have to let your colloid storage levels deplete and see if your follicle cells make enough thyroxine. And that could take up a month, up to a month's time. 3 months for you, that's a long time. And the whole time, if you're not making enough, what happens to your metabolism and your energy level? Goes down. So I wasn't willing to risk feeling like I had felt before. And so I said, nah, I think I'll just stay on the medication. And here we are 20 years later, still on the medication. So yeah, you do store about a month's supply in that colloid. It does decay over time, so it's having to constantly be replaced. But what this means is you have a steadily available supply no matter what. No matter if you're eating properly, if you're stressed or whatever, there is at least a storage supply available to us in this colloid of the thyroid gland. Okay, so on your worksheet there, you got a couple of blanks at the top. What do follicle cells make?
Thyroxine.
Thyroxine, good. Parafollicular or parafollicle cells make?
Calcitonin.
You got it, calcitonin. There is a great blood supply to your thyroid gland. So, of course, like all hormones, this one can hop in the bloodstream and travel and circulate throughout your body. So typical thyroid hormone setup here, travel the bloodstream till you get to your target organs. Okay, this is actually the largest purely endocrine gland in the body. A lot of our other glands are mixtures. So like the pituitary had pituitary tissue that was endocrine in nature and neural in nature. This is one that is entirely endocrine tissue, all epithelial tissue. And the only thing this thyroid gland does is make and release those hormones. So let's talk a little bit more about thyroid hormones or thyroxine. We kind of use the word thyroid hormone, which is TH, and thyroxine interchangeably. You know, technically there's two major thyroid hormones. Thyroxine is one of them. The other one is called triiodothyronine. Oh my gosh, what? You can use the abbreviations T4 for thyroxine and T3 for triiodothyronine. Okay, so the 3 and the 4 are actually clues telling us how many what? Iodines, yes. So the 3 and the 4 tell us how many iodine atoms are anchored into that molecule. Okay, so the 3 and the 4 actually tell us how many iodine atoms are anchored into that molecule. So which one of these, T4 or T3, is stored by your thyroid's colloid? T4, right. T4 is the one that is stored in your colloid. That is the one that's released in response to TRH and TSH, like we traveled over there on the board. Okay, so T4 is the one stored. Colloid in the thyroid gland. So T4 and T3 are just two very similar molecules structurally. T4 is the one stored in the thyroid gland. T3 is the one that is actually active at the site of cells. They only differ by a single iodine atom, but 80% of what you produce is T4 or thyroxine, And it's about 20% or less of what is in circulation is T3 or triiodothyronine. So you think, wow, my metabolism is actually run by the far less common hormone here. In order for it to be effective, it's got to be really strong. And it is. It's a really potent molecule. That's T3 I'm talking about. T3 is the one that is active at the site of your cells. So when T4 circulates, we call it free T4. It can also bind and travel to another protein called thyroglobulin. When T4 arrives at a cell, guess what it does to one of those iodine atoms?
Drops it.
So it kicks off an iodine atom. It goes into your cell as T3. And what does T3 now tell your cell to do? Speed up, right? Because this is metabolism. So it tells all your cellular machinery to run its reactions faster. Okay, so let me go back through that one more time. T4 is what your thyroid gland makes. T4 is stored where? Colloid, good. T4 is what circulates in your bloodstream. Okay, now when T4 arrives at a target cell, what happens to one of those four iodines? Drops an iodine. It enters the cell as a different hormone called T3. And T3's message for your cell is to increase metabolism, speed up metabolism. Your body temperature is controlled by thyroxine and T3. Your fat metabolism is controlled by these. How you feel, how clear of a mind you have is controlled by T4 and T3. So if you do not have these hormones working properly and in the right ratio, then you start to feel tired, you may gain weight, your hair may fall out, your skin condition may change to a lesser quality of skin. And that's just the beginning of it. So unfortunately, this is a hormone that really can wreck how you feel. Imagine days before we knew how to treat this, somebody would have to just suffer with having a low functioning thyroid gland and low functioning T4 and T3. All right, so which of these two is the more potent, T4 or T3? T3, good. Which one is actually made by your thyroid gland?
T4.
Yeah, mostly T4. And which one is the specific one that tells your cells to increase their metabolic rates?
T3.
Yes, T3. So we've got a kind of a tag team here, and they've got to work together. And of course, you've got to have enough iodine in your bloodstream in order to make these molecules both operate correctly. All right, so this is something that should look a little familiar. We know that the whole process of turning on thyroxine or T4 production does not begin with the thyroid gland. Instead, where does it begin?
Hypothalamus,
good. And what is the hormone that initiates the process? Thyroid releasing hormone, or TRH. What is the target of TRH? Good. Anterior pituitary. It now makes and releases TSH, which stands for? Good. And TSH targets your thyroid gland to make and release thyroxine. So to kind of play off of what you all did in lab, let me ask you this question. If we do not have a pituitary gland, what happens to thyroxine production?
Doesn't happen,
right? So your thyroxine levels will decrease. Okay? Does that make sense? Okay, so no pituitary means there are no messages being sent to tell the thyroid gland to release thyroxine. Okay, let's talk about another problem. Let's say someone has no thyroid gland. Of course, there's no thyroxine being produced, right? So what would you have to supplement with?
Thyroxine,
right. Would it help to give that person TRH or TSH?
No.
Because nobody's listening, right? No thyroid gland, no way to produce thyroxine. So when people take supplemental thyroid hormones, they're taking a form of thyroxine. Unithroid, synthroid, Levothyroxine, all those kinds of things are basically thyroxine. Let's go back up here. What if there's no hypothalamus?
You're dead.
You're dead, yeah. You really are. That's a deal killer, okay? So no hypothalamus means you got big problems. This is just a least of them, but yeah. So if there was no hypothalamus, if we were to pretend that, then what happens to this entire mechanism? It's gone, yeah, it's not happening. So no messaging is being sent. Let's go back to what we talked about last week. Is this an example of hormonal, humoral, or neural stimulation? It's great hormonal, yeah. Okay. So I mentioned to you the big issue here for thyroxine is to regulate your body's metabolism. And if you think about metabolism, it is all of your body's chemical reactions and how fast or how efficient they run. One thing that I haven't yet mentioned is this. Thyroxine and T3 also help to regulate your body's development. And I want to be very careful I don't say growth, because when I say growth, what hormone do you think of?
Growth hormone.
So I want to be really careful and not trip up and say body's growth. I want to say body's development. So at what time of your life does your body develop?
Puberty,
childhood. So when cells develop, then we're looking at thyroxine and T3 and helping to regulate that process. If you don't have enough T3, T4 as a child, then we see development issues, and they can be related to growth issues. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Okay. Let's see. I just wanted to mention also, there's a few disorders here we want to hit and highlight. They are on your worksheet. Since I have on your worksheet some lab levels, I thought I would just mention to you what they mean and how to interpret that. If someone is suspected of having some thyroid difficulties, a blood test can be run to look at TSH levels. That is a single test. That is the first test that they might run. It does not tell you the whole picture, because the whole picture, if we go back a slide here, is actually more complicated. If you're testing for TSH levels, what do you learn when you test for that?
If the signal's coming from the hypothalamus.
Right. If the signal's coming from the hypothalamus, telling the pituitary to release TSH. If you've got problems with TSH, this test does not tell you if the message is actually reaching the thyroid gland. So it's a snapshot of one piece of this mechanism. So given that, still, a lot of people will order a TSH test and say, okay, we'll figure out what's going on from there. A better thing to do would be a panel that looks at, say, TSH, T4, T3, and then you start to see where the communication issue is breaking down in this whole process.
My TSH stayed normal the whole time. I was losing all that weight. It's so overactive.
Which is fascinating that that was not through the roof, you know?
It was normal.
Wow.
So your levels can still be normal, but you still have a problem with your thyroid? Because the only reason why I ask that is my mom has a goiter, and she keeps getting them tested by her primary, and she's got
an endocrinologist.
Right. He keeps saying, I don't see anything wrong because your levels are normal, but it's still huge. I mean, she's dropping weight for no reason. She went from like 260-something and then dropped down to like 210.
That's a lot of weight to lose.
Yeah, so he said he didn't see anything wrong with it, but I guess you would want to go to an endocrinologist.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Because if they're testing this, you're not getting, there could be a firestorm like you probably had happening at this level, but it just may not show up there.
Right.
I felt like I was on fire. I was hot all the time.
Right.
I'd be sitting in a 60-degree room and be hot.
Right. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
She's always
couldn't go up a flight of steps because I felt like I was dying. It wasn't because I was heavy. It was because my heart would race so much. Mm-hmm. I feel like I need to sit down.
I got you.
Right. Right.
Okay. But everything's because you're fat when you're big.
Mm-hmm. When you go to the doctor, everything is lose a little weight, you'll be all right. I'm like, look, I am dropping weight. Take a look at how much I'm weighing every time I come in here.
Right.
20 pounds in a month. 20 pounds next month.
That's
3 months,
a lot.
I'm like 60.
That's a lot to lose.
But it's all because I was a very, very big girl then. I'm not little now, but I was very big when this started. And everything was because, oh, just lose a little weight and you'll be all right. You know, you'll be able to get up the steps fine. No.
And then when somebody has a heart attack down the road because of the thyroxine,
right.
Yeah, that is the problem. Yeah. In fact, you know, speaking of numbers being out of whack, when they did a TSH panel, you know, they may find that you're not really that far out of range. I had a T4, T3 done, and that's where they found them completely reversed. So you're supposed to have like 80% T4 and about 20% T3. I was actually flip-flopped. So
I'm struggling.
Yeah, struggle bus here, right? These numbers are just for conversation. If you ever have a TSH test run, the numbers depend on the laboratory, whether it's LabCorp or Quest or whoever's doing the test run. And the reason I want to have this conversation is because at first it may not make sense because it looks backwards to you. The TSH levels may be tested, and they may say that the laboratory's range is 0.3 to 3, and you may come back with something that's like 1.0, and you may feel awful, you may feel fine. It depends on you and your metabolism. If you're dropping in this direction, you're going into hyperthyroidism territory. So let me explain this. If you have a kid and you have a dirty room, you probably say to that kid, clean up your room. If you've got my kid, she doesn't listen. So I have to come back and say, did you clean your room? Did you clean your room? You know, and then it's like, you scream louder and louder and louder, right, to clean your room. So the more you have to tell the thyroid to do its job, the louder you scream. If you have the really neat kid who always has the nice room, everything's great, no trash on the floor, that kind of thing, you're probably not having to yell very often. Okay, so the less often you have to fuss at the thyroid gland, then
the more it's working.
Yeah, so if you have the great kid who never has to be told to clean his or her room, then that kid is probably working hard all the time to keep that room clean, right? That's how we get into hyperthyroid territory, meaning if the pituitary doesn't have to yell at the thyroid gland to make its hormones, the thyroid gland is really on the ball making its hormones, maybe too much so making its hormones. Let me explain it the other way. Let's go up this way. If the kid has a really dirty room, your volume gets louder and louder and louder to do your job. And that means that the kid's probably not listening or not wanting to clean or whatever. So the anterior pituitary is constantly having to yell at the thyroid gland saying, sluggish, speed it up, put out more thyroxine, do it, right? So it's screaming at that thyroid gland. And this number, TSH here, gets higher and higher. So if the number gets higher, then we're looking at hypothyroid territory. So this doesn't seem right, does it? The higher the number, the slower the gland is working, and the lower the number, the more efficient the gland is working. So if you're down here near zero, then your thyroid gland is just doing its thing, and maybe all by itself it's doing its thing. And that may not be a good thing, because this is a negative feedback loop, right? And so if it's negative feedback, the levels of thyroxine should ultimately feed back where? All the way back to your hypothalamus. So let's do this. If you have too much thyroxine, what does that do to our levels of TRH? Turns them off, so it lowers them down, and that happens to also lower your TSH levels, right? So it's a feedback mechanism that should operate, but if you've got, you know, cells that do their own thing and don't listen to this mechanism, then they may either hypersecrete or hyposecrete, depending on what's going on there. So just a little history behind the numbers. It may look backwards to you because the higher you go, the less the thyroid's working on this scale. And the lower you go, you know, the more the thyroid gland is just pumping out hormones all on its own. Does that make sense? Okay. So looking at that, let's talk about these disorders here. Let's start off with hypothyroidism disorders. And these happen to be insufficient thyroid hormones. And I just put TH there. That could be thyroxine, which is T4, or it could be triiodothyronine, which is T3. Okay, so it could be T4, it could be T3, it could be that signaling mechanism between hypothalamus, pituitary, and thyroid gland. The first one there is called myxedema. We also have congenital hypothyroidism, an old name for it's cretinism. I'll mention goiter also under that category. On the other extreme, we have hyperthyroidism, and that condition causes excess thyroid hormones in the bloodstream. Graves' disease and goiter best fit in this category, so we'll talk about those two as well. Okay, so if you're an adult and you have a sluggish thyroid gland and you're not producing enough thyroid hormones, then you could end up with a very severe case of hypothyroidism, which is called myxedema. Do you see the word edema hidden in there? What is that? Swelling? Yeah, that's swelling. So if you happen to have myxedema, then we do see swelling as part of the problem. So when a person has too little thyroxine or thyroid hormones, we tend to see things like hair loss and dry skin. Here's the big ones. This is what you really experience. It's bone-numbing fatigue, not being able to think clearly, feeling like you're in a brain fog all the time, kind of like when you wake up in the middle of the night and can't get your bearings straight, that kind of mental fog, but all the time. We do see a slower heart rate because the thyroid hormones do influence heart rate, and we also tend to see weight gain. So even if someone were to put themselves on a very strict diet and say, I'm going to go on 500 calories a day and I'm going to lose weight, thyroid hormones have such control over you, you may not be able to battle that. You may not be able to lose any weight, even if you restrict your calories. So this process here really slows down all the metabolic machinery of your cells. These people have myxedema, and I think there's one really obvious thing to look for, and that's their eyes. Yeah, notice their eyes have swelling all up underneath. This man had his thyroid problem fixed, and he went from having swollen eyes and face to what looks like a slimmer face. And so it's all about maybe supplementing him with thyroxine levels to help make sure that he had enough to manage his bodily functions and fluids properly. So you don't think about the fact that metabolism ultimately influences how much fluid you retain and how swollen you can be. He may not have been simply person with excess weight, he might have just been swollen with fluids. So how would you treat myxedema? What would you give somebody who has hypothyroidism? Let's go back here. This will help. Would you give them more TRH, TSH, or maybe some T4, T3? Where's the problem? That's right, because it's probably not here because dead, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So your pituitary, your thyroid.
It's probably it. Probably pituitary or thyroid. Yep. So if it's in fact the thyroid, then the fix is going to be thyroxine, some type of synthetic hormone that we could administer. Does that make sense? Okay. So it's probably not hypothalamus. What kind of tissue makes that hypothalamus up? Nervous tissue. So nervous tissue is not like epithelial that makes up our endocrine glands like pituitary and thyroid. So the good news is for a myxedema patient, the treatment, if it is in fact a sluggish thyroid gland, is pretty simple. We can supply extra thyroxine, and hopefully that will help to bring their levels and their body swelling down, bring their levels back up, make them feel a little more energetic, which, you know, is hard to do.
I had a problem with that when they took my thyroid out. I didn't respond to the generic levothyroxine. It wouldn't convert to T3 in my body. I had to have Armour or Synthroid.
Yep.
That was a rough 6 months.
That is awful because you keep waiting for it to kick in
and
work.
You sleep all the time. You feel like you're dead.
Yeah. I will not take generic because of the potency problems. I'll take only the brand names.
That's no joke with that. Because I always thought that was ridiculous because I grew up taking generic everything. Mm-hmm. My mom was a nurse, so we believed in generics, but that did not work.
That, I agree, yeah.
A lot of thyroxine that they gave me that was generic was trash.
I had 30-day supplies, and every time I would switch from one to the next 30-day supply.
But you had to go through with the insurance company.
they had to do so many labs on me to prove that it was not working.
So you could get the name brand?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you feel like death.
6 months of, I feel like I'm gonna fall asleep sitting straight up.
Yeah, that's awful. This is an awful gland to have out of whack. The worst.
You don't think about all the things it controls until mm-hmm. it's not there.
That's right. You take it for granted as long as it works okay, you know. All right, so let's talk about people that are born with thyroid issues. Nowadays, I don't know if you know, but when babies are born, they prick them pretty good. They get some blood samples from them. Poor baby's born, and first thing we're going to do is poke you. So when they poke them and they take a blood sample, they're actually testing for thyroxine levels because it's really important that from day one you have proper thyroxine levels. Why is it so important?
You
won't grow and develop properly. And I'm really trying to avoid that grow word.
Well, your cells don't divide properly, nothing happens, right?
That's right. They don't mature like they're supposed to.
You basically won't function properly.
You won't function properly.
Your mitochondria don't work right, right? Without the T3.
Right.
Your mitochondria don't work.
They don't run at that rate they're supposed to. So that drives everything. Yeah. So back in the day before modern medicine, you know, and I'm not talking that long ago, but back in the 1950s and 60s, we weren't fully understanding how all this worked and that we should be testing babies that are born. No matter what, we test them to see if their thyroxine levels are okay. But babies that were growing up without proper thyroxine in their system ended up with this congenital hypothyroidism problem. Back then they called it cretinism, but now the name for it is congenital, meaning from birth hypothyroidism. Classic signs here, we see underdeveloped body, weak muscles and bones, thick skin, but this is the real issue. It's mental retardation because thyroxine drives the development of all of our cells, including the nervous system. So it's really critical that we can avoid this congenital issue by simply providing thyroxine to those babies born without enough of it. So these are some people with congenital hypothyroidism. It does cause dwarfism, and you'll notice here we've got a man who's in the 4 foot range. Technically, to be a dwarf, you would be under 4'7". So we see the dwarfism that comes with this. We do see poor development of the nervous system. So yeah, nowadays, we screen for it and we treat for it from day one. This is an interesting case. This was an A&P textbook that I got at a flea market back in the 1950s. I'm not that old. It was a book from the 1950s. And it's really cool because nowadays they don't publish a lot of this stuff because it simply doesn't exist anymore. So this was a girl with cretinism, and she looks like she's 4 or 5 years old here. It's obvious she has not gone through puberty. It looks like she's fairly small for her size. All these things tie in with congenital hypothyroidism. So what do you think they did that made her change like this? What did they treat her with?
Thyroxine.
What happened to her in those 2 years? Puberty, right? So what does that tell you about thyroxine and sex hormones?
It's permissive.
Permissive, right. So her ovaries may have been producing estrogen, but because thyroxine wasn't there, there's no change in the body's, you know, puberty-like changes. You know, no breast tissue, no fat deposits in certain areas. So unfortunately, that meant that she would hang like a person who was prepubescent until she got enough thyroxine. So in 2 years, she grew in size. She went through puberty just thanks to thyroxine. Really important for giving permission for those sex hormones. We saw this picture last class period, but I did want to mention, this is congenital hypothyroidism, and he has a normal size torso, and his arms and legs are small in comparison, kind of like a person with achondroplasia, these two here. These two people, as a reminder, have pituitary dwarfism, meaning that they didn't have enough what hormone? Growth hormone. Yeah, these two didn't have enough growth hormone, so their body stayed childlike in proportion, by comparison, notice that this one has cretinism or congenital hypothyroidism, and that's a thyroxine problem. So he may have had completely normal levels of growth hormone, but thyroxine wasn't present. So once again, what does that tell you about thyroxine and its relationship to growth hormone?
Permissive,
yeah. So boy, you know who runs the body now, right? The boss. What's that?
Thyroid is the conductor.
Yeah, thyroid is a conductor. Thyroid's either there or...
The band's playing all kind of crazy stuff. Every
instrument. That's right. Or the band ain't playing at all. Yep. Yep. Okay. So let's talk about goiter for just a moment. Goiter can typically be a iodine problem, although the thyroid gland may enlarge for other reasons. It may enlarge because it's hypertrophying from, like, your condition. So anytime you have a lump around where the thyroid should be, and if you feel your trachea, you should feel a little knot there. That is your thyroid cartilage on your larynx. Right below it should be a little fleshy thyroid gland. Oftentimes, if you have a physical done, someone will run his or her hand here and ask you to swallow, and they're probably feeling for how that gland feels around your trachea. So that gland, of course, can get bigger if it doesn't have the items to operate, or if it's just growing wild and out of control. One reason it may grow bigger is because of lack of iodine in your bloodstream. Why is iodine important for the thyroid gland?
It's in thyroxine.
It's in thyroxine. How many atoms?
Four.
Four. And how many are in triiodothyronine?
Three.
Okay, so gotta have the iodine for those molecules. And of course, if you don't have it, then the thyroid gland may in fact enlarge and become a goiter. So it's calling for iodine and it's trying to concentrate it so that we can then make T4 and secrete it from the thyroid gland. Okay.
That's why salt's iodized.
That's why salt's iodized, yep. Best source of iodine is seafood and fish that come from the sea, the ocean, not lakes, right? And what?
Shellfish, clams.
Yes, shellfish, clams, those kind of things. So if you like seafood and you eat it on a routine basis, you're probably getting some iodine from those kinds of organisms. Interesting though, this shaded area here is an area of the U.S. that doesn't have very good iodine in the soils. That includes the Great Lakes. So if you happen to fish from the Great Lakes thinking, I'm getting some seafood and I'm going to have some iodine, nope, yep. So no iodine or not enough iodine in those areas. So what do you think people that lived in this region of the country developed? Goiters, yeah. So about 100 and some years ago, they discovered that, yeah, easy way to fix this problem is to iodize salt. So you're right, put iodine on the salt. So if you go to the grocery store, you may in fact pay attention and notice that there are iodized and non-iodized salts to buy. And if you want to make sure you have enough iodine in your diet, then iodized would be your choice there. Somebody who may want to avoid iodine and choose the non-iodized salt would be who? If you got a hyperactive thyroid, yeah, you may want to say, I don't know if I want to make it worse, crazier yet. So somebody may want to avoid it if they have hyperthyroid problems. So to deal with a goiter, one thing they may do is simply say, hey, get some more iodine in your diet. They may prescribe a certain type of diet. Thyroid hormones may be a way to help supplement because they do contain those iodized hormones. If it is unresponsive to any of this treatment so far, then they may do surgery or a radioactive iodine pill. And that radioactive iodine pill is taken up by the thyroid gland and it effectively kills the tissue from the inside out. So you don't have to have surgery if it's effective. It just kills the tissue.
That's what they were going to do, but the Bethesda test came back saying I had stage 4 cancer.
Gosh.
So that's why they removed mine instead of just killing it.
Well, if they had known that it wasn't.
Oh, yeah, we thought I was dead.
I'm sure that was like a very stressful time. And then to find out that it was just.
That's when I told you that it took them 6 weeks to get the pathology back to whether they needed to do the iodine, the radioactive iodine, or just, you know, whether I was a goner.
Right. You're probably thinking during those 6 weeks, you know, what in the heck?
They sent it to a bunch of different cancer treatment centers to identify it.
Wow.
I had a guy in Saudi Arabia finally figured out what I had.
Wow.
A doctor over there.
Had to leave the U.S. completely.
Yeah.
Wow.
He said he had treated a family that had that same follicular mutation in the thyroid.
And
three generations.
You mentioned you have some familial issues.
Everybody
with this.
Everybody in my family's got it. The guys,
wow,
too.
Wow.
Something with the thyroid.
That's,
my aunt had the identical same mutation I do.
That's nuts. Nuts to have it think it's stage four. And
yeah, the test does not detect the type of mutation that I have. It reads it as stage four cancer.
Wow.
Because it grows so fast. I thought it's medullary cancer of my thyroid, which is the most dangerous, and it's not. So the test is flawed, so a whole bunch of people are getting thyroid adjuvants that don't need them.
That's a scary thought, too, because then you're talking a whole host of other issues. Yeah. Wow.
Weird.
Yeah. Some extreme goiters here. Okay. So they can squeeze the trachea. They can make it hard to breathe, or they can make your voice raspy. Okay. So let's talk about this condition here of hyperthyroidism or Graves' disease. Not to make light of this condition, but it can put you in the grave because of this right here, tachycardia. That means what?
Fast heart rate.
Fast heart rate, right. So you look at this, you say, oh, wow, weight loss. But, you know, like you were saying, 20 pounds a month you can drop with this.
It's scary.
Yeah, this is not the kind of weight loss you want to have from hyperthyroidism. The reason that this can kill a person is it can cause the heart rate to increase and overwork. And unfortunately, that can cause the heart to wear itself out. So tachycardia there, that is the real issue with this condition. Other symptoms that come along with having Graves' disease or a severe case of hyperthyroidism, all of these come from having the metabolism rate really ramped up and running fast. That includes the bulging eyes, the thinning of the hair is growing too fast to be thick. That means that we're gonna have things like flushing, hot flashes, intolerance to heat. Somebody who's you know, not cold natured, this is the person who's hot natured, sweating, peeling off clothes, almost like a woman with hot flashes, but it's like all the time. So that's where this can put you in terms of how you feel. Like you said, nervous, running wide open. It's not a very comfortable place to be with this kind of situation. So let me talk to you about bulging eyes there for just a minute. Because one of the conditions that comes along with this, if it's left untreated, is a condition called exophthalmos. And this is basically what happens when the tissues behind your eyes grow so fast, they push your eyes out. So those tissues will push until your eyes start bulging from their sockets. Unfortunately, this is an untreatable condition. So once a person has gone to this level of Graves' disease, there's nothing they can do to put their eyes where they're less bulged out. The thing to do, of course, would be to catch this before it ever gets to this point. What problems do you think this person with bulging eyes might experience?
Can't see.
Can't see, headaches.
Blurred vision.
Yeah, blurred vision. Even scratched corneas because their eyes may be drying out or may be damaged more easily. So the tears should drain across and flush your eyes, but in certain cases here, they may just be so bulged that they have a problem with keeping their eyes moisturized like they should be. This is actually somebody with exophthalmos who had her eyes worked on. It looks like they actually did try to sew them shut so she could get some moisture to her eyes. She actually lives in this area. So, you know, it's just a really sad situation to get to this point of exophthalmos where it causes such damage to the eyes. So they were trying to make sure that her eyes stay moisturized. This was shortly after she had them sewn shut so that they could stay moisturized there for a while. All right, let's go back to this. Hyperthyroidism in the extreme is called Graves' disease. So all of this stuff here, difficulty sleeping, fast heart rate, weight loss, heat insensitivity, is all due to too much what?
Thyroxine
T4, right. So again, this is your metabolism running wide open with excess thyroid hormones. Okay. So a lot of stuff there about thyroid and thyroxine. Any questions so far? Any parts you need to hear again or need clarification on? All right, so let's talk about calcitonin for just a moment. Calcitonin, like its name implies, regulates what ion? Calcium, good. And where is it made inside the thyroid gland? Yeah, parafollicular cells. This one's not stored in the colloid. Only T4 is stored in the colloid. So this one, made by the parafollicular cells, will hop in the bloodstream and travel throughout our bodies. What is the target or target areas of calcitonin? Bones, good. Does calcitonin help to increase your blood calcium or decrease your blood calcium? Decrease, good. So going way back, does this particular hormone activate osteoclast or blast?
Blast.
Good, blast. So blast, osteoblast, will then in turn deposit the extra calcium to your bones. Just a quick detour. We haven't talked about the heart yet. And up to this point, we've only talked about calcium as being an issue for bones and bone strength. What we're going to learn in this class is calcium is extremely important for muscles, not just skeletal muscles, but also your heart muscle. And the reason we need to have an immediately available supply of calcium is for those muscles to operate properly. So you may think back to troponin and tropomyosin and calcium, how it regulates muscle contractions. That's why these hormones are really important. And having calcium in the right range is going to be an important issue for us. We'll talk more a little later on that. All right, so do you know the antagonist to calcitonin? Parathyroid, yep, PTH. So if you'll flip on over with me, this is page 10. I like easy stuff. This one's easy. Parathyroid gland makes parathyroid hormone. Check. That's it. Okay, so easy. Where do you find the parathyroid glands?
Behind the thyroid.
Behind the thyroid, good. There's 4 to 8 nodules of tissue back there, like we were talking earlier. If you have the thyroid removed, they will try to tease apart those tissues. They want you to keep those parathyroid glands because they help regulate calcium levels. The hormone that helps regulate calcium levels that comes from the parathyroids is called what? PTH. Yep. So PTH is the abbreviation for parathyroid hormone. Sometimes they shorten it to parathormone, but you can call it PTH if that works for you. Okay, so this one's a treat. It's easy after you've been through the thick mess of anterior pituitary over there. Really easy one to remember. All right, so let's talk about PTH for just a moment. This particular hormone will increase blood calcium levels. What did calcitonin do?
Decrease it.
So they're working against each other. They are great examples of
antagonists,
right? So calcitonin lowers blood calcium. PTH will raise blood calcium. And it does so by using osteoclasts. Good. They will help break down bone tissue, releasing that calcium back into the bloodstream. Okay, so this one is an antagonist. Just a couple of questions down here for thought. What do you think breastfeeding, what effect do you think that has on bones?
Takes calcium out of your bones to make the milk.
Yeah, it takes calcium out of the bones to make the milk. The way you get the calcium out of the bones is PTH, right? So there's an old, really old saying. You may never have heard this one before, but it goes like this. For every child, a tooth is lost. Meaning, when mom has a baby and breastfeeds her baby, her teeth may fall out. Okay, ever known anybody who's gotten cavities or loose teeth or damaged teeth when they breastfeed? Okay, so that's possibly the effects of PTH leaching calcium wherever. And that may be your teeth, it may be your bones. So they say that when mom breastfeeds a baby, she may lose 2-3% of her body's skeleton. She can't drink enough milk or take in enough calcium to replenish that. When she stops breastfeeding, then her body rebuilds those bones. But unfortunately, it may be just enough to cause tooth decay or tooth loss or, you know, bones to be leached just during that time period. So we do rely on PTH to help provide calcium and breast milk to babies. We did the last question there. We know the antagonist to PTH is which one? Calcitonin. Good.
Is that why they tell you to wait 18 months between your kids?
Probably, because it would probably kill your skeletal system. Yeah. That and all the other effects on the muscles and whatnot. Yeah. I just wanted to mention that PTH, like many of these hormones, have more than one effect. We primarily think of PTH as being the one that targets the bones to raise blood calcium. We know that osteoclasts play a role in breaking down that calcium. So that's what you've probably heard if you talked about PTH and calcitonin in Bio-210. I just wanted to mention these two things here because they play an interesting role in the body. PTH also targets the kidneys, and it tells the kidneys to increase calcium from the urine back into the bloodstream. Oh boy. What if you take a lot of calcium from the urine? You got kidney stones, right? Okay, so some kidney stones are calcium-based. There may in fact be a link for some people between kidney stones and parathyroid hormone levels. So I just want to mention that because this course is great at helping us make connections between different systems. So PTH could in fact cause excess calcium if it's hypersecreted. Likewise, PTH also targets the kidneys and causes us to reclaim as much calcium as we can from the foods that we eat. That too can also cause intestinal problems such as cramping. So I just want to mention that PTH is not just targeting the bones, it also targets other areas like the kidneys and the intestines where we can reclaim that calcium from urine that's being formed or from food that's passing through. Interesting picture here. This is somebody with their head leaned back. You can kind of see the nose, chin, and ears area here. And these are those four glowing nodules of parathyroid tissue. So perhaps they may be looking for that if they're suspecting that someone has an overactive parathyroid gland. So just a thought here. If you have hyperparathyroidism or excess PTH, what do you expect to see in terms of blood calcium levels? Too much, right? And where are we getting that calcium from? Bones, yeah, kidneys, reabsorption from food and intestines, but yeah, one major place is bones. So excess calcium, as we'll learn later on, is going to be a big problem for our heart, especially the heart tissue. All right, so it looks like we've made it to the bottom of page 10. How about questions there? All right, so I'm just going to get you a little bit into page 12, just for food for thought, and then that'll be all our time today. So the adrenals are our next set of endocrine glands. They are found on tops of the kidneys. In fact, the adrenal glands have two regions. They have an outermost region and an innermost region. That outermost region is called what? Cortex. Good. The innermost region?
Medulla.
Good. Which portion is made up of endocrine or epithelial tissue? Cortex, good. And how about the medulla? Nervous tissue. So I kind of think of your adrenal gland like an apple. You've got the flesh on the outside that is the endocrine tissue. That's called the cortex. And if you get down to the core, we probably don't eat that core. And the core of your this endocrine gland is nervous tissue. That's the medulla or medullary region of that adrenal gland. Let's go back to our chart on the board over there. CRH and ACTH, which specific region do those hormones target? The cortex, right? So ACTH is the one specifically coming to the adrenal cortex to bring about a change. So we don't actually have a mechanism that brings about change in the medulla. That's actually our autonomic nervous system housed in that area. There's actually three regions of your cortex. They're called zones, and they're outermost to innermost. You've got zona glomerulosa. That is our outermost layer of the adrenal cortex. We have a middle region that is called zona fasciculata, and a very deep region that's called zona reticularis. Let me give you a helpful hint here. The hormone classes that are made here all have a corticoid ending. Does that have a meaning or a significance to you? Corticoid? Comes from the cortex, yeah. So corticoid says, hey, I come from the cortex of the adrenal gland. Okay, just happens that these three classes of hormones, they are steroids. So corticoids come from the adrenal cortex, and all three happen to be steroids. So if they're steroids, how do they communicate with their target cells?
Bardrightian.
I am here to cause change, right? So where's the receptor for your steroid hormone?
Inside,
right, it's intracellular. So these three classes of hormones here barge right in. They use direct gene mechanisms. They go right to that intracellular receptor that's sitting inside your nucleus. Just some food for thought for you to take home with you over the weekend. Mineral corticoids are steroid hormones made by the cortex, and they regulate minerals like sodium and potassium, okay? What do you think glucocorticoids regulate?
Sugar.
And, of course, gonadocorticoids, well, the clue's there, it's sex hormones. But what are they regulating? Gonads, right? Okay, so I would encourage you to read about aldosterone on the bottom of page 12. That is going to be a huge influencer in this course. This is not the only time we talk about it. It comes up again and again throughout this class. If you will read about the renin-angiotensin mechanism and all the things that can stimulate aldosterone's release in the bottom of our page, we're going to start with that when you come back to class on Tuesday. Do y'all have any questions for today? Everybody get the sign-in sheet today? Y'all have a good weekend.